Hello, everyone. Welcome to the Road to Recovery podcast. This podcast is a platform for education, discussion, and conversations on mental health. I'm your host, Amira Shah, and in this podcast, you'll get to know more about the therapeutic process, insight into life from the perspective of the psyche, and also join me in exploring current issues with other practitioners. I specialize in grief, but I'm always interested in learning about the human experience of the mind, heart, and spirit. So join me on this journey of in-depth learning about ourselves and the world we live in. Hello everyone, and welcome back to Science of the Soul. Today I have with me Dr. Karen Hills. Karen has been a counselor for 25 years in private practice. She was a lecturer for 11 years, a lecturer of counseling. She works with individuals and couples, but especially her special interest lies with children and adults with autism and a variety of disabilities. She started her career as a registered nurse and successfully combined both careers to pursue what she's passionate about. I met Karen a couple of years ago when we were working together and lecturing in the School of Counseling, and she was actually my boss, and we had such a wonderful time working together. So thank you, Karen, for doing this with me.
Oh, thank you for inviting me. Very nice to see you, Amira.
Always, always. Now, Karen, I heard from the grapevine that you are now retired. So what's going on in your life?
Well, retired's an interesting word. I've left my formal work, but I still do lots of bits and pieces. And so I supervise a number of PhD students and have see the odd client for counselling. But I'm pursuing an interest of mine. So my PhD student, my PhD's thesis, and most people turn theirs into a book, but mine was published by publications as I went along. But I'd really like to turn that thesis into a readable book for more people that would never think of reading anything academic. Mm. So my thesis was on autism, and I looked at people right on the severe end of the autism spectrum, which my children are not on that severe end. But there was a lot of my own personal journey as a mum. So I have two adult sons, both with disabilities. And so it was a personal journey that brought me to the point of wanting to explore what the life was like for someone with a severe disability, and people on the severe end of the autism spectrum don't communicate with speech mostly, and so it was just learning about how do they make meaning of their world differently informed from the rest of the population. So that's my book.
Was that qualitative, your research?
No quantitative.
Yeah, it
was very hard to find participants, actually, that didn't speak, but that I could communicate with. So
qualitative, but you couldn't speak with them. So how did you...
I couldn't speak, but I could communicate.
Writing?
So they typed to communicate.
Oh, yeah. That is so cool.
Believe it or not, there's a group of non-verbal poets in Brisbane.
Really?
And most of my participants were a part of that group. They're published poets, very intelligent people, the same spectrum of intelligence as you would find in the general population. Amazing people. They just communicate differently.
Oh, wow. That is very cool. Thanks for sharing that. I never
Thank
knew
you
that.
For asking.
So yeah, tell us a little bit more about this book that you're working on.
Well, it began, my interest with people with disabilities began with my own journey as a mum. So I have two adult sons, as I mentioned before. Both of them have quite significant disabilities. My oldest son was diagnosed in utero with a condition that everybody told me was incompatible with life outside the womb, a very rare condition called fetal ascites. And so he wasn't expected to live. He's now 35 and doing really well.
Mm.
My youngest son was born with hydrocephalus, which is fluid on the brain, and he's also well placed on the autism spectrum.
Mm.
So my journey as a mum was interesting and different from other journeys. And I learned a really important lesson. Took me a long time to learn it, and I went kicking and screaming into learning this lesson because it wasn't my dream. Mm. It wasn't what I wanted in my life, but it was the path I found. And when I came to start looking at my children and seeing the little people that they really were, and seeing even though they approach life differently, they bring enormous gifts to the world. And when I started recognizing those gifts and seeing the significance of who they are, my attitude to people with disabilities really changed.
Mm.
And I began to see their worth and value that's often overlooked in the world. Because we prize things like superior sportsmanship and intelligence, and we forget sometimes as a society how the people that do life differently bring enormous gifts to the world too. So that's kind of what I want to demonstrate in this book.
Do you have any stories to share with us, like a little snippet?
I can tell you one from both of my children's lives.
Okay.
So my youngest son, I'll start with him. He's quite the sportsman. And so he's had a lot of interest in sports, but he's a very good 10-pin bowler.
Mm.
And just this weekend, he competed in an able-bodied league of a premiership of all the bowling alleys and leagues around Brisbane, Gold Coast and Northern New South Wales, and he came in a whopping second, bowling two personal bests, and he came second by one pin.
That is so incredible.
So I'm a very proud mama today.
Oh, wow.
So that's very exciting. My older son is very different, and he doesn't let any challenge beat him. And I just remember one, I could talk all day, so I don't want to take up all the time, but there's one anecdote out of his life when he was a little boy making his way in the world, and he was about 7 or 8, something like that, and it was sports day at school. Always a hard day for mums with kids with disabilities.
Okay.
And anyway, he came up to me on the day and he said, "Mum, whenever I run in a running race, I always come last. And I'm not very sporty myself." And so I said to him, "You know, mate, I always came last when I was a little girl too." And he said, "Oh, I don't mind, Mum." He said, "At least I come somewhere and at least I get a point for my team." And right there on that day, I saw the gift of somebody who is less worried about whether they win and where they come, and is more worried about how they're making an effort and even coming last gets a point for their team. I couldn't have been more proud.
Mm.
And so these are the gifts that if we look hard enough, we find all sorts of gifts like this are with people that don't have the same typical life choices as everybody else.
Those are really heartwarming stories. Thank you for sharing that. But it's so true.
Pleasure.
It's like when you're not, I guess when you're in a different world, when your world is different, you are less tempted because you have less opportunity to compete and strive in the mainstream world.
Mm.
And then this whole other world opens up to you. And one might even say that it is more in tune with your authentic self.
Mm.
And you're more present with the things that you can do and you're able to do and contribute. That's cool. Thank you.
It seems counterintuitive to how society really operates because we prize excellence.
Mm.
And there's nothing wrong with that. There's nothing wrong with that. And I don't criticize anyone. I pride that in my own life.
Mm.
But when people excel at different things, like at kindness, at participation, at inclusion, when people excel at those things, they're really valuable too.
Yeah, and they probably have a longer lasting positive effect on their own lives and the people around them as well, because it's not like I bought this new car because I got this new job and I'm doing really well, and then, you know, after a few months the car is like a car, you know. Yeah. But then it's when it comes down to something as deep as participating for the team so that the team can get a point, or things that I guess propel or fertilize, you know, virtues.
Yeah.
Then those things stay forever. Like, this story is from when he was 7 and 8.
Yeah.
This is like 30 years ago. So,
I've learned a lot over the time. And, you know, it actually being a mum of children with disabilities has become my identity in a lot of ways.
Oh, yeah.
Not my whole identity, I guess, but a really big part of my identity. And it's led me down a path of my own life that I really didn't expect, but has been very, very rewarding.
So would you consider yourself in the golden years now? Is that what it's called?
Well, I don't like to think of myself as aging, but I guess I am.
Mean in terms of like life milestones kind of thing.
Yes, I'm probably in the last quarter of my life.
Okay.
Although my mother's 89.
Oh.
And not looking like slowing it down anytime soon, so I'm hoping to repeat that. I hope that's in my genes too.
I hope you get like 5 books out.
Yeah,
well, at least
better get cracking.
Okay, so there are a couple of things we were thinking to talk about today, and one of the things that you highlighted, an area of interest apart from working with autism and disabilities, was narcissistic personality disorder. And this has been a buzzword for a long time now. And earlier we talked about whether or not this was something that has become more common, or we're just more aware of it, you know. So what are your thoughts?
So first and foremost, you're right. I do think it's a buzzword. And it's come to the point that just in the general community, I come to see that anyone that's a bit difficult or anyone that doesn't do what you want them to do, it's easy to call them a narcissist.
Yeah.
And a true narcissist is something very different from that. So I might start with describing a true narcissist.
Okay.
Generally, as the research tells us, is that somebody with narcissistic, well, the first and foremost thing to remember about a narcissist is that they will never admit that they're a narcissist or don't even see themselves like that. So it's very hard to diagnose. That's the first thing. And a narcissist never goes to the psychologist anyone and says, I think I'm a narcissist.
Can you help me with my narcissistic traits?
Yes, because that's the first thing. So it generally comes from a partner report or something like that, that we have something to build on. But generally, more often than not, the narcissist will not admit that or work with them or look at themselves in any way. So generally what narcissism is a very poor sense of self and very fragile identity. And so that any criticism or any hint of a flaw impacts their personality and their sense of self so deeply that they can't function, so they attack. So generally a narcissist, but not always, has some kind of abuse in their childhood. Now that can be actual or perceived. And so a lot of people find well, we know across the spectrum, one person's experience of something will build strength and somebody will be very resilient, and another person's experience of the exact same event. So take the Holocaust, for example. Some people survived and some people didn't, purely on their ability to cope with what was going on around them. And I mean, it was horrific. I don't take that away. But so some people will have a trauma in their childhood, and that will create a whole way of being for them thinking that the world is out to get them and that they have to defend themselves and somebody else is not like that. There's two types of narcissist. There's the grandiose narcissist. He's or she is the one that is the center of attention at all the parties, talks about themselves, is a great speaker, and everybody loves and knows, but those in intimate relationships with them have a very different experience. So they become grandiose with their expressions of everything. Then there's the vulnerable narcissist. That's the person who is more quiet, more insidious in a lot of ways, also has a very fragile sense of self, resorts to gaslighting and those kind of things to survive. Partners of either type of narcissists never fare well. So there's a lot of gaslighting. Actually, both types of narcissist will gaslight, shift the truth, do anything to turn the focus of any problem onto the other person. Lots of blame and lots of the shifting of realities.
Because of the gaslighting.
Hey guys, thank you so much for tuning in to Science of the Soul. This is a short interruption to let you know that if you or someone you know are in need of more support, you can find me at Road to Recovery on my Facebook page, my Instagram, or my website at aroadtorecovery.org. I hope you've enjoyed listening so far, and now let's get back to the podcast.
Do you have a sense of the prevalence between grandiose narcissism and vulnerable narcissism in terms of population or gender or, you know, any sort of demographic background? Or do you think this is pretty much across the board, across humanity?
That I don't know, whether one's more than the other. I do know that we're not exclusively more narcissists are male. Than female. Now I've got my theories about that, but I don't think it's ever been studied. But women tend to talk about their issues and work through things when they happen, where men are less likely to find that socially acceptable to do. So but anyway, it's more often than not men. But there are women narcissists out there. Generally, they will seek a very docile partner, a giving partner that they can manipulate. And when either the partner wakes up or something bad happens in the relationship, it can be quite troubling for the partner and children. There are also narcissistic parents that create a lot of mental health issues for their children as well.
I can't speak so much in terms of research and statistics, but just from professional experience, quite a number of the people I've come across in counseling as clients who come to me because one of their partners or their partner is had narcissistic traits or a parent. Turns out one child would kind of copy and mimic the narcissistic parent and the other one would be the one that placates and, you know, stays out of trouble and stays out of the way and is just quieter in general.
Absolutely.
Okay.
So it can go one of two ways with families, and it's very interesting. Family of origin stuff is so very interesting. But generally, one partner will become like one child, will become like the narcissistic parent. And the other child will become codependent. So they feed it almost by being codependent and supporting the person way more than they should in their bad behavior.
And so with the tendency of, say, for example, the codependent child, would that codependent child be attracted to the similar pattern of a narcissistic individual as a mate?
Yes, absolutely. And very often, the codependent child has codependent friendships, falls into its patterns throughout their whole life,
right,
where they continue to get hurt.
Mm.
And so it takes a lot of self-reflection and inner work, personal work, to step out and to be able to maintain their own boundaries and be able to stand up for themselves and love themselves.
Yeah.
So generally, if someone's been in a narcissistic family where there's narcissistic abuse as a child, then they will the codependent one will try to seek the attention and love of a parent that's unable to love anyone but themselves.
Mm.
And so then they go through life trying to find love,
but mimicking the same pattern over and over
again. By being giving and loving and caring and supportive. So they are immediately attracted to people that need a doormat, which is the narcissist. So it keeps finding people. Very sad.
Yeah.
But there is a solution. The solution is never that the narcissist will grow and become self-aware.
Right. I mean, it's a wishful thinking.
It's very wishful.
It's not something that's within anyone's power.
No. And very often a narcissist is too insecure, so that they do all the blame. And so their big way of coping with anything in life is to project it back and to blame. So very often a narcissist will be the ones that have the affairs and do the things in a relationship, but they blame the other person. They can be physically abusive, but it was their fault they asked for it.
Right.
Do you know, it's those kind of patterns that are repeated.
And how did you fall into this area of research and work? It's so far from disabilities.
It is so far. So it came from
the other spectrum.
Personal experience.
Okay.
So, and I probably don't want to talk about it too much, but when my marriage broke down, a therapist said to me after the marriage had broken down, very clear, there was a lot of narcissistic rage from your husband. And so I went and started exploring that, and it was like, oh my gosh, that's totally us. And so then I started doing a lot of reading and a lot of exploring and started to see patterns in clients that I was working with and in friendships and in other things. And I started to see where my life, the trajectory that my life had taken because of life events. And so that was where I first started. But then it became interesting for me to work with people, although I don't use the word narcissist in a counselling session because it's counterproductive.
Yeah, and it's labely. And
you
get someone's defences up and working.
And they won't accept it anyway. It's more about, in counselling, helping both parties see the dynamic, the dance, and how they interact, and then changing the steps of the dance.
Okay.
And inevitably, when the codependent or non-narcissist partner starts getting some self-awareness and defending themselves, the marriage will fail because the narcissist loses control.
Okay, so when you see a couple that walks through your door and you spot from, you know, your spidey senses, from lived experience and from professional experience, do you have this notion in your mind that goes like, 6 months before the marriage falls apart, for example?
You know, the Gottmans predict within 97% accuracy when they see some of the four horsemen, you know, that the marriage will fail. I think sooner or later, it depends. Generally what happens is that the narcissist, once they see that the therapist is onto them, they won't come back. They'll find a therapist that will tell them what they want to hear. And so they won't come back, and they won't do the work, and they don't do the couple work. So it's up to the vulnerable person or the the partner to support themselves. And so that's where they should seek support, to support themselves, to have very clear boundaries.
And how do you, if you were to give some suggestions, how do you, what would you tell parents or families who are exposed to narcissistic traits, very strong narcissistic traits within the family, in terms of how to care for the children, what to look out for, so that they're not so deeply impacted by the individual that's, you know, the most overbearing in the household?
It's very difficult, okay. Because there's so much power and control. So generally, somebody who's codependent will encourage the children to be codependent.
To placate,
to keep peace at all, keep peace at all times. Don't just shush. Don't stand up for yourself. That kind of thing. The general consensus amongst experts is that it can't get better. Unless by a miracle. That the narcissist is willing to look at themselves, but that very, very rarely happens.
Yeah.
And it will only happen if they're forced for some reason.
Yeah, like backed into a corner.
Yeah, yeah.
I have two things to share. One is more of a comment slash maybe discussion question. But before I bring that up, I've actually come across this podcast by Rick Hansen and his son, Forrest Hansen, the therapists. And it was a wonderful podcast on dealing with and managing relationships with a narcissistic parent or a family member or a partner in terms of how to connect and speak your word, your truth, maintain boundaries, but also be compassionate and empathetic enough to not trigger the defenses of the narcissistic personality. And it's such a good podcast, and I'm going to link that in this podcast as well, because I've shared it with quite a number of my clients and friends and family as well. So I just wanted to mention that, and I'll share that with you as well. It's a really good one.
Okay.
The other thing I wanted to talk about is, because the narcissistic personality disorder sounds like there's a very, like you said, very weak sense of self, and therefore the ego is being built up to be all the things that society would deem prized. And so building that facade of an ego, not to an extent, it is them also, like, you know, engaging in study and work and philanthropy and whatnot. And I wonder if one of the only ways to get to that ego dissolution would be through psychedelics, because that's what it does. It breaks your ego, and there's nowhere you can go, and there's, like, you're backed into the corner in your internal world, and it's basically smashing you, smashing through layers of your built.
So ego. I can't really speak very informed about that in terms about psychedelics and narcissists.
Yeah, I know. It's a new area. I'm just, so I thinking.
But my idea would be that I just wonder how deeply entrenched the lie is for the narcissist. So their sense of who they really think they are is so deeply entrenched. Would they recognize the person that they would meet when they were in a different vortex?
I don't know. Maybe they'll see that person as a mirage or a representation through a different means. I don't know.
Wouldn't like it, though.
But that's what it is. Like, psychedelics usually show you your demons, right? You don't get to...
narcissists, they don't have any demons. Everyone else has them.
That's interesting. Someone should do some research on this.
Oh, I think so.
But how do you get participants if they don't recognize themselves as having that personality disorder? Very interesting.
Very interesting and very difficult. But I think, just very personally, I think narcissistic disorder represents is a fractured spirit. And I think it's a very spiritual journey for a lot of people, and it's a very fractured spirit. It's very sad because they're not happy people, but they've lost their ability, and a true narcissist can never love their partner for who their partner is. They love their partner for how their partner makes them feel. So the minute a partner makes them feel something they don't want to feel, then there's anger and blame and finger pointing and abuse even. So, and the partner never feels loved because their whole worth is dependent on how the narcissist feels. So a classic example of that is the husband, and not all narcissists are men, but is the husband that buys the wife a lot of jewelry, beautiful jewelry, where normally a wife would feel very blessed to be given so much jewelry, but it's not for the wife, it's so the husband looks like a very good husband because of the narcissism.
Oh, that's so sad. I'm already sad just thinking about it.
And but it's very hard to see through as well.
Which is why you said only the people in the household, in relationships with them, would be able to pick up on it or see a totally different reality of them. And do you have any, apart from the things you've shared with us, do you have any tips or suggestions or recommendations for people who are in relationships or know, close relationships or know of people who are codependent?
So if you think that you're in a relationship where you're never heard, never respected, and that the realities keep shifting, I'd seek professional help from a therapist, and certainly find a support group.
Okay, a support group. Was that something that you found useful? Did you go through that?
No, because I didn't really recognize it until after the marriage had broken down. And so I became my own support group, really, because of just the journey that I was on.
So you went through this massive journey of self-growth from being married to someone with narcissistic traits, or is it like definitely a narcissist?
Well, I reckon I diagnosed him. He's never been diagnosed, so.
All right. Of course.
Yeah.
So you had to come out of that and also raise two children with disabilities. So you're, I should just change your name from Dr. Karen Hills to Mother Karen.
Mother.
Like Mother Teresa.
Oh, no.
In terms of like the spiritual growth and the self-growth that you've been through, can you...
Well, firstly, I'd like to say most of what I learned by making a mistake, I learned the hard way. And so I can't say that I did anything so fantastic. What were the choices? Do you know?
Yes, exactly.
You know, the choices were either to crumble or to get up and be the best mum I could, because that's what my boys needed. So I didn't do everything perfectly. And I think a lot of times, particularly when they were little, I put a lot of pressure on them and myself for them to be performing like everybody else was. I've relaxed all that now. But that was a big lesson to learn. It wasn't easy. And it's been a journey that I will say peppered with heartbreak. And watching my boys be hurt and taken advantage of and bullied just because they're different has broken my heart. Watching them try and negotiate systems like Centrelink and the NDIS has broken my heart. I often say to the Centrelink lady, listen, I've got a PhD and I can't
figure out how you work.
I can't do this. So how do you expect my child with a disability to be able to put in the right information? And so it wasn't easy. So it was peppered with hardship, but it was also peppered with undescribable joyful moments where I see Mitch win a bowling tournament, when I see my other son Sam with his moderate intellectual and mild physical disability graduate from university.
Yeah, that must have been huge.
It was enormous. Proudest day watching him. And there's a whole story there, how we set up a program to support him with his studies, and he battled through one subject a semester until he passed. And, you know, and now he'll and then we wrote a paper and put his name on the paper because it was about him. So he's a published author.
Wow, really?
Because he had a voice. He had a voice in the whole process, and he worked so incredibly hard to achieve his dream. So
you found a lot of, I'm going to paraphrase, but you found a lot of empowerment through your numerous heartbreaks, because you had to keep getting up, and then you've kind of you modeled that, and therefore your kids received that sort of spirit as well, and then your clients and your students.
Hopefully. You know, the one thing I'll say is that fighting the systems like the Centrelink and the NDIS, that fighting is exhausting.
Right.
And I wish, if I had a dream, I wish that the government recognised the enormous amount that it saves because of mums and dads that do the right thing for their kids. And the biggest worry for parents, a huge worry for me and other people like me, is what will happen to my child when I'm not here anymore?
Yeah.
Who will care for them like I do? I constantly, you remember what it was like at work? My phone rang all the time with a crisis for one or other of the children, and I was constantly unraveling things for them and supporting them. In fact, just last week I got a funny phone call from Centrelink trying to work out Mitchell, because he'd gone onto the MyGov account and filled in that he owned multiple properties and had a multi-million-dollar trust.
Oh, what?
Why was he? Yeah, and I just laughed. I said, he's not got capacity for any of this. He, you know, and anyway, we worked out that he'd just ticked all every, like on the form, he went in there for, just thought he could do something on MyGov, and he went in, changed everything. And so we got it all sorted. But, you know, there's always a drama like that. Mm. And who will care for these people? Because socially, friendships are very rare. Semi has a lot more friendships. He's more outgoing. But friendships are rare, and support people like that are rare, you know, mostly for people with disabilities to have a lonely journey. You know, often there's many, many people in Australia, in the world, where they've got a disability and their only relationships are with the people that are paid to care for them.
Mm.
And some of those people aren't good.
Yeah. And to be honest, because I also work with a lot of NDIS clients, my heart breaks at how, you know, they can just lose so much of their funding because the person behind the scenes is siphoning here and there for what so-called work that they've done.
Or haven't done.
And yeah, they are lonely. Quite a number of them are from refugee backgrounds as well.
Yeah.
And so you've got disability plus like hardcore PTSD and, you know, a lot of trust issues, loneliness because they're away from their families, and then NDIS systems that don't work for them.
No.
So I think there should be a lot more onus on ethics and ethical practice when it comes to NDIS. But yeah, I think since it's a relatively new system, there's a lot of teething problems that people are figuring out. But there are a lot of really awesome people I've worked with as well who, you know, I feel really comfortable. You know, one of the clients I have, we have a whole like chat group with the whole support team, and I'm the counselor. I speak to the person once a week, but even their daily supports, you know, giving case notes on the WhatsApp group. The father has been, you know, involved in that group as well, so everyone knows what's going on. I thought that was just so cool.
Yeah.
Whereas some of my clients, it's just like crickets trying to get in touch with the support coordinator or the plan manager. It's just impossible. Where are they? What's going on?
And because they're busy. They're overworked. Yeah. Those people have their own lives, but you can't just ring them up and get an answer to a question like that,
yeah,
it's incredibly difficult.
Yeah. And the portal. Sorry, yeah. No, I'm going on a tangent. But the portal. Oh my gosh.
I know.
Anyway. Thank you so much for taking your time today and speaking with me. And
my absolute pleasure, Amira.
Yeah, and I learned a few things as well. I'm hoping that we get to speak a little bit more next time.
Mm-hmm.
I want to pick your brain on other things.
Okay.
But yeah, thank you very much. It's been an enlightening chat, and it's been really nice to catch up with you again.
Likewise. Thank you.
Bye, everyone.
Bye.